Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Making Sense with Steve Laser. We have a terrific show this week. Topics include a congressional scorecard and news about the 2014 congressional elections and other elections coming up. Then we have the deteriorating conditions and chances for a positive outcome in Syria. Then an update on the IRS issue. Was the IRS justified in taking a closer look at tax-exempt applications by political groups? Then a woman is fired for being pregnant and files suit against a Roman Catholic archdiocese. We'll also have our trademark weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. If you want to write to me and give your opinion of any topic I cover, write to makingsenseletters@yahoo.com, and I may just read your opinion on the air. That's makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. So we'll get started with our first segment right after a word from one of our sponsors.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
Welcome back. So how's Congress doing? Also, we have news about some important upcoming races as well as the 2014 congressional elections. Yep, it's already time to start talking about those. Well, it may seem that the 2012 elections were just yesterday, but we're actually one quarter of the way through this legislative session. And just as a reminder, as I covered this previously on a show, this past election was one of only four times of the 50 congressional elections in the last 100 years where a majority of the people in this country voted for one political party but got a House majority of the other party instead. More people voted for Democrats than Republicans in this last election, but they got a majority of Republicans in the House of Representatives instead. Now, this happened due to Republican gerrymandering of districts in many states in 2010. So, folks, let's start with the very real fact that the people of this country did not get the government they wanted in the House of Representatives. Now, that being the case, you would have thought that House Republicans would be humble and candor and would be reaching out to make sure that they were doing the kinds of things that the people of this country want them to be doing. Now, of course, Republicans being who they are, they're doing the exact opposite. So what has this Republican House of Representatives done with the first 25% of their term? And as a further reminder, before I get into that, we're still in an economic recovery that is fragile and fraught with potential dangers. So what did this Republican House of Representatives do? Well, the only thing of note that they've done on the economy is to refuse to work with the president to find a solution to the fiscal cliff crisis and also to try to cut food stamps for needy families. For his part, the president actually went so far, and I've criticized him for this several times, but he went so far as to offer to cut Social Security and Medicare in order to try to meet the Republicans halfway. Now, this is an important point, and it really shows the tone and character of the Republicans in the House. The president offered them their wildest dream, a Democratic president offering to and giving Republicans cover in cutting Social Security and Medicare. They refused. Why did they refuse? They refused because they want so badly for this president to fail and to be blamed for that failure. They want it so badly, they will not work with him at all, no matter what he proposes. It's really quite extraordinary when you consider the amount of work that needs to be done on the economy and jobs. And we're getting partisan political games from Republicans. We're getting nothing from House Republicans. They're totally and utterly disinterested in trying to create jobs. So outside of the economy, what did we get from Republicans in the House? Well, for the 37th time since 2010, this past week, House Republicans voted to kill the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Now, we all know this is a waste of time because in addition to passing the House, it would need 67 votes in the Senate in order to override what would be a certain presidential veto. And, of course, the problem there is that Democrats have 53 seats in the Senate, so that's not possible. The funny thing is that Republicans like to claim that middle and lower class workers in the United States don't work hard enough, that they're lazy. And they claim that union workers in particular don't work hard enough. But here they are, totally wasting time in the House of Representatives on a bill that they know has no chance of passing the Senate and getting a presidential yes vote. They're going through the motions, essentially on a task that they know is a total waste of time. And to do it, they're getting paid around $200,000 a year. They get months and months off, and in addition to that, the Republicans in the House are wasting time with this nonsense. So we have Republicans refusing to work with President Obama on the economy and jobs, no matter what he proposes. We have them acting out on a useless and time-wasting gesture of trying to repeal Obamacare. What else have Republicans in Congress done? Well, Republicans in the Senate have refused to confirm any of President Obama's judicial and other appointments. One nominee, Caitlin Halligan, was initially nominated in September of 2010 to fill the seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. She was up for votes in 2011, 2012, and then finally again in March of 2013, where her last chance at a cloture vote in the Senate was 51-41 in favor. But, unfortunately, because Republicans have been misusing the filibuster, 51-41 was short by 9 votes. What else are Republicans doing? Well, Republicans in the House and Senate, but particularly House Republicans, are spending a lot of time investigating the so-called scandals that I've been debunking on this show for the last 2 weeks. And I also debunked them on an appearance on Fox News, where I explained how the IRS scandal in particular is not a partisan issue. I'm going to talk about the IRS scandal a little bit later on the show again. But Republicans apparently feel that the time they've wasted passing bills to repeal Obamacare is not enough wasted time. So now they have to waste lots more time investigating these non-issues they keep trying to present as scandals. And when I say that it's a waste of time, I'm saying that with confidence, knowing that nationwide, approximately 3/4 of you would rather the Republicans spend their time trying to fix the issues with the economy and unemployment. A poll by Quinnipiac University that was released this past Thursday found that 73% of American voters nationwide believe that dealing with the economy and unemployment should be a higher priority than the investigations. Imagine that. So that's what 3/4 of the people of this country want, but I can guarantee you it is not what you all are going to get. And by the way, that says a lot about what people believe in terms of the seriousness of lack thereof regarding these so-called scandals. In other words, people don't put a whole lot of credence in these issues that Republicans have mostly manufactured. We can emphasize that point if we look at how the president's popularity has not been hurt in the least by these issues. A recent poll by my friends at Fox News shows virtually no movement in the president's popularity for the last year or so. He's generally been at around 52% favorable and 46% unfavorable, plus or minus 1 to 3 points over the last year or so. So what we have is Monica Gate all over again, in terms of a Republican House of Representatives determined to use ginned-up scandals to impede the legislative agenda of and otherwise hurt a Democratic president. And just like that situation 16 years ago, the people of this country are rejecting the Republican narrative. They want Republicans to stop ginning up outrage, and they want them to concentrate on putting people back to work. Now, I think this disconnect between what the people of this country want and what the Republicans are giving them is starting to have an effect on the 2014 elections, even 17 months out. I know it's early, but for instance, TPM reports that Kentucky Secretary of State Allison Grimes, who's a likely challenger for Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell's Senate seat, is tied with the minority leader in a hypothetical matchup with him, according to polling done by Public Policy Polling. PPP noted that McConnell's early positive advertising has done nothing to improve his prospects for re-election. And in fact, this is actually the weakest position PPP has found him in yet. In April, PPP found him leading Grimes by 4 points, and in December, he had a 7-point advantage over her. McConnell continues to be unpopular, with 44% of voters approving of him to 47% who disapprove. His numbers are even worse with independents, only 41% of whom think he's doing a good job, while 53% give him poor marks. Grimes, on the other hand, has a positive 32% versus 24% negative favorability rating. So, obviously, as I said, it's still early. But think about it. What exactly has changed since December that has caused a 7-point swing in McConnell's polling versus Grimes? I think it's obvious. I think it's Republicans' continued focus on scandal mongering and continued lack of focus on the economy and jobs. There are a couple of other big pieces of news with regard to the 2014 elections. One of them is, according to the Detroit Free Press, that former Democratic Congressman Mark Schauer is running to try to unseat Republican Governor Rick Snyder. Now, if you recall, Governor Snyder will forever be known as the guy who ramrodded through a right-to-work law aimed at killing unions in the home state of United Auto Workers. In addition to that, he has been cutting school funding and raising taxes on seniors, according to Mr. Schauer. So getting Mr. Snyder out of the governor's mansion will be a big Democratic priority in 2014. Hopefully we can get that done and pass a bill to repeal this horrible right-to-work law in Michigan. Then, of course, we have the announcement from the lunatic Michelle Bachmann that she will not be running for re-election in 2014. Representative Bachmann, who represents part of Minnesota, is famous for saying crazy things like the HPV vaccine causes mental retardation, or in August 2011, she alleged that God sent a hurricane and an earthquake to get our attention in the U.S. And then there's my personal favorite in 2009 when she said, carbon dioxide is portrayed as harmful, but there isn't even one study that can be produced that shows that carbon dioxide is a harmful gas. In fact, there's dozens of studies out there that say that many people have been killed by releases of carbon dioxide gas near volcanoes and other type of situations. But folks, you know how nutty Michelle Bachmann is? I'll tell you how nutty she is. Among the nutty characters that ran for the Republican nomination for president in 2012, she was by far the nuttiest. She was so nutty that when she attacked the other candidates, they just smiled and continued on as if she hadn't said anything. In other words, they not only think that she's crazy, they are so confident that enough other people also think that she's crazy that they don't feel that they even need to refute her accusations. Among that bunch, she stood out as being nutty. There's an accomplishment for you. Finally, in the New York City mayoral race, Anthony Weiner is now polling second after having formally declared his candidacy a week and a half ago. He's polling at 19%, while frontrunner Christine Quinn is polling at 24%. There are three other fairly strong candidates, so this is very far from over. There's a lot of time left in this race. But it's interesting to see Wiener polling so strongly coming back from his embarrassing scandal. That's a race that I'm going to continue to watch and report on for you. The thing that's most interesting to me with regards to 2014 is whether the people of this country will come out and redouble their efforts to try to get the government that they wanted when they voted in 2012. You know, as I noted earlier in a few other shows, the country voted for Democrats in 2012. The country didn't get what it wanted. And now Republicans are running the House in a way that is completely contrary to the wishes of this country. Will they pay a price for that? Now, in the other direction, pulling things in the other direction, Republicans typically do better in midterm elections as more Democrats than Republicans tend not to turn out in election years where there's no president at the top of the ticket. So how will that turn out? People upset at Republicans for not doing the things they want, but Democrats tend not to turn out as much in midterm elections. I'll be providing periodic updates on the 2014 elections over the next 17 months, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, BADLER.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. Now, the deteriorating conditions and chances for a positive outcome in Syria. The developments in Syria make it look more and more like the chance of any kind of a positive outcome in that country are remote. You know what? I'm going to get to that in a second. I have to mention this. I didn't know if I was going to do this, folks. I think this is important. I have to mention this one particular side note in the Syrian issue. You see, every once in a while, we're presented with a stark contrast, an example of how Democrats and Republicans behave. You see, there are folks out there who say that there's no difference between the two parties and their politicians. But one example of how untrue that is a recent study by PolitiFact of claims made by Republican and Democratic politicians and pundits during the first few months of President Obama's second term. PolitiFact found that 52% of all Republican statements are untrue, while only 24% of statements made by Democrats are untrue. That's a pretty amazing statistic right there. But we recently had another example, and this one regarding the Syrian issue, of how differently Republicans and Democrats behave in what are similar situations. Now, I'm not just doing this to poke fun at Republicans, although as usual, they richly deserve it. This difference goes to the heart of whether members of Congress have the right to go to the source and learn firsthand about overseas groups and leaders. First, I want to take you back to April of 2007. George W. Bush was president. Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House. And Speaker Pelosi led a congressional delegation to Syria to talk to President Assad on a host of issues. Now, this is the reaction from Mitt Romney, who was in the beginning stages of his first run for the presidency in 2008.
Now, the Speaker of the House helped to dignify a state sponsor of terror. At this time of war, her action stands as one of the most partisan, divisive, and ill-considered of any national leader in this decade.
Tell us how you really feel, Mitt. Now, let's review some choice quotes there. Quote, dignify a state sponsor of terror, end quote, and one of the most divisive, partisan, and ill-considered of any national leader in this decade. Oh, what a joke Romney was. And thank goodness this guy never became president. That is ridiculous, hyperbolic demagoguery. Now, some Republicans hearing this might say, yeah, well, Laser played one clip, and it was from someone running for office, and people who are running from office often exaggerate and attack the other side to show differences, et cetera, yada, yada. Okay. So let's hear, if you don't want to take Romney as an example, let's hear from some other Republicans and conservative leaders. How about what President George W. Bush himself said at the time, as well as Brian Darling, who is a spokesperson from the Conservative Heritage Foundation? And this is their comments in a CNN clip with John Roberts.
Today, House Speaker and Democrat Nancy Pelosi arrived in Syria, but today in the Rose Garden, President Bush put it plainly.
One thing to send a message is another thing to have the person receiving the message actually do something. So the position of this administration is that the best way to meet with a leader like Assad or people from Syria is in the larger context of trying to get the global community to help change his behavior, but sending delegations hadn't worked, just simply been counterproductive.
Well, we ought to mention that Speaker Pelosi is not the first lawmaker to take a controversial trip overseas, and President Bush is not the first president to complain about it. This goes way back. With some of that in mind, perspective now, let me start with you, Brian. First of all, do you think that this is a public relations victory for Assad?
Yes, it is, and it's a real problem. I mean, we have the President of the United States leading our country. He's a commander-in-chief of our armed forces. He's a chief diplomat. And now you have Speaker Pelosi traveling to Syria and trying to engage in diplomacy. It's inappropriate. It's a bad idea. As a nation, we need to speak with one voice, and today we are not speaking with one voice.
So we have heard now about Pelosi's visit to Syria in 2007 from the Republican president of the United States at the time. We've heard about it from someone running for the presidential nomination in 2008 and who was the Republican Party's nominee for president in 2012. And we heard from the spokesperson of one of the most prominent conservative think tanks on the subject. That's how Republicans dealt with that situation. Now, as most of you know, Senator John McCain went to Syria last week to talk with the Syrian opposition. To further show how similar those two situations are, Pelosi's visit and McCain's visit, there are claims, with some pretty good evidence, that some members of the Syrian opposition have ties to terror organizations and are extremists. A spokesperson for the State Department was asked about Senator McCain's visit to Syria. Now, you just heard how Republicans reacted to Pelosi's visit to Syria in 2007. How would a spokesperson from the State Department, David Ventrell in this case, under a Democratic administration, react to the reverse situation, and how would he answer questions from the press about it? Let's listen.
Senator McCain was in Syria, northern Syria. Have you been able to get any kind of readout or talk to him, his office?
I'm not sure the Secretary has been able to connect yet with Senator McCain. They do talk fairly frequently, so I imagine they'll get a chance to have a conversation about his trip. But we do understand the Senator crossed into Syrian territory and refer you to his office for more details of his visit.
Did you know about him going?
We are in touch with various members of Congress about their travel when they're overseas, so we stay in touch with them, but I'm not going to get into the details of our communication with an individual senator about foreign travel.
And I would have also thought that there might be legal issues.
Right. Well, we stay in close touch with members of Congress as they travel overseas. You know, the State Department does provide a role for many members as they do travel throughout the world. I'm just not going to get into the specifics on this particular trip.
As a matter of course, when such a high-profile American goes on a trip like this, it is assumed or presumed to be coordinated beforehand with you guys, correct?
The point, though, is that each individual senator, member of Congress, has their own prerogative and their own positions, and they represent their constituents, and they have their own policy positions, so they're able to speak on their own.
So is there a difference between Democrats and Republicans beyond the obvious policy differences? Is there a difference in the amount of spinning, posturing, and lying, in the amount of demagoguery used by Democrats and Republicans? Absolutely. And you just heard a good example of that. Yes, there's a real question of a conflict between the Logan Act, which is a 1799 law which seeks to reassert the president's sole authority to negotiate with other countries, versus the rights of members of Congress to individually engage with foreign leaders and learn for themselves what those foreign leaders and groups are about. But there's a way to discuss that without hyperbole and demagoguery. One party seems to be able to do that, the other doesn't. It's the same way on a host of other issues. We should all never forget that. Now, getting back to the issues on the ground in Syria. The developments over the last week or two suggest to me that we're not going to get any kind of positive outcome in Syria. One of the things that's come up is that the White House has asked the Pentagon to draw up plans for a no-fly zone in Syria. An article in the Daily Beast by Josh Rogan shows that advanced plans for a potential U.S. or multilateral intervention are coming together. The administration has been pursuing what it calls a dual-track strategy of preparing for conflict, but vigorously pursuing a political solution. An administration official told the Daily Beast, quote, "The White House is still in contemplation mode, but the planning is moving forward and it's more advanced than it has ever been. All this effort is to pressure the regime, and it's part of the overall effort to find a political solution. But what happens if Geneva fails? It's only prudent to plan for other options," end quote. Now, at the same time that this is happening, Russia is sending advanced surface-to-air missiles to Syria. In fact, some of those missiles, we've gotten reports that they may have actually already arrived. These are the S-300 PMU-1 missiles, described by Wikipedia as known by the NATO name SA-20 Gargoyle, and they're regarded as one of the most potent anti-aircraft missile systems currently fielded. Its radars have the ability to simultaneously track up to 100 targets while engaging up to 12. So think about those two things that I just talked about. Think about we might have a multinational no-fly zone being put up in Syria, led by the U.S., and on the other side, the Assad regime having an arsenal of some of the most advanced Russian surface-to-air missiles. Now, that to me sounds like a match made in hell. For their part, the Israelis have been lobbying Moscow to halt the deal, and a few days ago warned that Israel regards these missiles as a threat and is prepared to use force to stop their delivery. Syria's Assad, on the other side of things, has warned Israel about airstrikes. Israel has engaged in a number of them already inside Syria. And Assad is now threatening to respond in kind to any new Israeli airstrikes. Assad also made a pretty disturbing, vague reference to opening up a new front of resistance in the Golan. If you're unfamiliar with the Golan, Israel has occupied what's known as the Golan Heights, which is an area bordering, I guess is what you would call it, the region's disputed, but it's bordering Israel and Syria. Israel has occupied them since the 1967 war. So this threat ostensibly indicates Syria will move on the ground against Israel. Hard to imagine that they would do that, but just mentioning it ratchets up the tensions in the area considerably. So we have a potential air battle shaping up between Assyria with advanced surface-to-air missiles and, you know, any no-coalition, no-fly zone that might be attempted to be erected. We could have Israel striking at Russian ships delivering those missiles or an airstrike against them once they've been unloaded or in the process of being transported. We have Syria threatening air and ground military action against Israel if they're subjected to additional airstrikes. And, you know, as bad as that is, that's not all, folks. I mean, the proverbial icing on the cake, as far as I'm concerned, is that we have increasing engagement in the Syrian civil war by Hezbollah. A BBC article last week talked about a Syrian doctor seeing the bodies of many fighters from Hezbollah in Qusair, a town that's seen a lot of fighting between rebels and army units loyal to President Assad. General Salim Idris, a commander of one of the main groups of Syrian rebels called the Free Syrian Army, told the BBC on Wednesday that more than 7,000 Hezbollah fighters were taking part in attacks on Qusair. General Idris warned Lebanon's president and the Arab League that he gives 24 hours for Hezbollah to withdraw its fighters from Syria, or the rebels would target Hezbollah fighters wherever they are. Most likely, left unsaid, but most likely Lebanon. Hezbollah's increased involvement in the Syrian conflict is an escalation that will make a positive resolution to the civil war much more difficult. Over the last 30 years, Hezbollah has been a big problem and obstacle in the way of having a stable democratic government in Lebanon. They operate and maintain their own army, separate of that of the country. That sort of a thing is never good for democracy. They're well-versed in guerrilla tactics and use them with great success against Israel several times. And that just made me think, if Israel has problems dealing with Hezbollah, what success can the Syrian rebels have against them? So from all that's going on here, I think we're going to see a prolonged, bloody struggle in Syria followed by a lawless failed state. I hate to say it, that's the way things look to be going as far as I'm concerned. Now, I think one of the things that could help prevent that, I doubt this is possible, but I think what has to happen is Russia, the United States, and Europe need to back off. They shouldn't get any more involved than they already are. They should pull out of any sort of involvement. They shouldn't sell any of the belligerents in Syria any weapons. And they should let the people of Syria and the region sort it out between themselves. I think that anyone who gets involved in this mess will likely be sorry for it. We'll be right back.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and it's the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes. Florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business, makes you sensational.
And now, was the IRS justified in taking a closer look at tax-exempt applications by political groups like Tea Party groups? Folks, I'm going to need to explain what is meant by the law that provides for tax-exempt status in order for you to understand why I'm actually starting to think that the IRS actually did nothing wrong here. So it's going to take a few minutes, I'm going to ask that you stay with me, because once you understand what these statutes are about, I think that you'll find that not only was the IRS unfairly maligned, but there's absolutely no scandal. So just as a reminder, it's alleged that certain groups, particularly conservative groups, particularly Tea Party groups, have received unfair attention from the IRS during the application process to receive tax-exempt status. Now, the full name of the statute for tax-exempt status, like many other laws, is really long and has all these subparagraphs, but it's Title 26, Subtitle A, Chapter 1, Subchapter F, Part I, Section 501, Subsection C, and is organized into some 28 or 29 different kinds of organizations by number. So 501c1 through 501c28 or 29. Now, political groups have been using the 501c3 and 501c4 statutes to apply for tax-exempt status. Now, the one that has had the most issues, and also in a way is the most attractive to political groups, but the one that's had the most issues in terms of organizations not meeting the correct terms for that status is 501c4. According to the IRS, some 300 organizations that have been granted tax-exempt status under these two designations are under investigation for engaging in improper activities. And when I say improper activities, that means they did things outside the bounds of what you're supposed to do to receive tax-exempt status under the type of organization for which they applied. So 501c4 status applies to civic leagues or organizations not organized for profit, but operated exclusively for the promotion of social welfare, or local associations of employees, the membership of which is limited to the employees of a designated person, or persons in a particular municipality, and the net earnings of which are devoted exclusively to charitable, educational, or recreational purposes. Now, you notice that there was the term social welfare in there. That's very important to understanding this statute. Social welfare is defined in the dictionary as, quote, organized public or private social services for the assistance of disadvantaged groups. So in our quest to understand what the statute is about, let's plug that into the definition of the statute. 501c4 status applies to civic leagues or organizations not organized for profit, but operated exclusively for the promotion of organized public or private social services for the assistance of disadvantaged groups or local association of employees, the membership of which is limited to the employees of a designated person or persons in a particular municipality, and the net earnings of which are devoted exclusively to charitable, educational, or recreational purposes. Now, to make it easier, let's recognize that the Tea Party groups don't fall into the second part of that, right? They're not a local association of employees belonging to a particular municipality or employed by a particular municipality. So let's take that part out of the definition. 501c4 status applies to civic leagues or organizations not organized for profit, but operated exclusively for the promotion of organized public or private social services for the assistance of disadvantaged groups. That's what political organizations have to meet to qualify under 501c4 status. So right away, you know, I think you see the problem, right? That does not sound like a Tea Party group. It doesn't sound like most political groups would fit that definition at all. That sounds like a nonprofit group that is formed to feed, clothe, or shelter needy people. It sounds like a nonprofit group that might be trying to train unemployed people into new careers, right? Doesn't sound like a Tea Party group. Doesn't even sound like most liberal or progressive groups. Now, I should also point out that the statute allows 501c4 organizations to, quote, inform the public on controversial and subjects and attempt to influence legislation relevant to its program. And unlike 501c3 organizations, they may also participate in political campaigns and elections as long as its primary activity is the promotion of social welfare. There's that phrase again, right? This time, it's as long as its primary activity is organized public or private social services for the assistance of disadvantaged groups, it can inform the public on controversial subjects and participate in political campaigns and elections. Now, there's one more important point about that regarding 501c4 groups. The statute says that 501c4 organizations are not permitted direct or indirect participation or intervention in political campaigns on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for public office. That's really important. So now that we fully understand what those statutes are about and what those groups are supposed to be about under those who fit those statutes and what they're allowed to do, what they're not supposed to do, let's do some examination of some of the Tea Party groups who applied for tax-exempt status and were flagged for additional review. A May 26th article in the New York Times by Nicholas Confessori and Michael Luo talks about the statute in relation to some of the Tea Party groups that applied for tax-exempt status. Confessori and Luo note that CVFC, a conservative veterans group in California, applied for tax-exempt status with the Internal Revenue Service, and its biggest expenditure that year was several thousand dollars in radio ads backing a Republican candidate for Congress. The Wetumpka Tea Party, another group applying for status, they're from Alabama. They sponsored training for a Get Out the Vote initiative dedicated to the defeat of President Barack Obama. And they were doing that while the IRS was weighing their application. Another group, the Ohio Liberty Coalition, the head of the Ohio Liberty Coalition, and their application languished with the IRS for more than 2 years. But the head of that organization sent out emails to members about Mitt Romney campaign events and organized members to distribute Mitt Romney's presidential campaign literature. Those are some of the groups the IRS targeted and who are now crying foul. So it's easy to see that these groups don't meet the criteria for tax-exempt status under that statute, right? Under a 501c4 designation, groups are not permitted direct or indirect participation or intervention in political campaigns on behalf of or in opposition to any candidate for public office. Now, I haven't talked so much about 501c3, right? But the reason is that the rules for 501c3 groups are even more restrictive. 501c3 groups can't spend any money at all attempting to influence legislation or on any kind of political campaign activity. So it's hard to see how any Tea Party group would meet the criteria for either of those two kinds of organizations. No wonder the IRS flagged their applications. Few political groups that I could think of would qualify under either statute. So of course Tea Party groups are flagged. It's obvious that a group dedicated to promoting the Tea Party, its principles, and its candidates would not fall under the statute. It's also easy to see why liberal or progressive groups might not be flagged immediately, right? There's a much stronger chance that a liberal or progressive group might actually be about promoting social welfare, i.e. organized public or private social services for the assistance of disadvantaged groups. Note that I said much greater chance, right? I didn't say that they definitely would qualify under the statutes. I still think most liberal and progressive groups wouldn't qualify either. So I think a lot of us who criticize the IRS probably owe them an apology. I criticize them, and I apologize. They were right to flag the Tea Party groups. And as I said repeatedly, I can't think of a way a Tea Party group would qualify under the statute. It's really that simple. We'll be right back. And now it's time for our weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. First, our Hall of Fame for making sense. Winning the Hall of Fame this week for making great sense is former Republican presidential nominee and former Republican Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole. Bob Dole was on Fox News Sunday last week and was asked about today's Republican Party versus the Republican Party he knew from 8 years as a Republican member of the House of Representatives from 1961 through 1969, and then 27 years as a Republican senator from 1969 to 1996, including 9 years leading the Republican caucus in the Senate as either minority leader or majority leader.
In your first 2 years as a senator, there were 7 motions filed, cloture motions, to end debate. In the last 2 years, there were 115 cloture motions. Is the filibuster being abused where it now takes 60 votes to pass anything?
No doubt about it. There are some cases we can probably justify it, but not many.
What do you think of your party, of the Republicans today?
I think they ought to put a sign on the National Committee doors that says closed for repairs until New Year's Day next year, and spend that time going over ideas and positive agendas
You described the GOP of your generation as Eisenhower Republicans, moderate Republicans. Could people like Bob Dole, even Ronald Reagan, could you make it in today's Republican Party?
I doubt it. Not Reagan couldn't have made it. Certainly Nixon couldn't have made it.
Now, Republicans through the blogosphere have been ridiculing Dole for his statements. But this is a guy who led the Republican Party's caucus in the Senate for nearly a decade, less than 20 years ago. And he's saying that the Republican Party today is crazy, off the rails, and does not have a positive agenda. And Dole's right. He's obviously right. I mean, Republicans of the 70s, the 80s, even the 90s, the early 90s, they wouldn't make it in today's Republican Party. They'd be considered too liberal. In fact, we can make it easy and say that any Republican taking office between 1995 would almost all be considered too liberal by today's standards. Now, we've seen a number of these guys and women lose primaries and end up being drummed out of office by far-right-wing Tea Party candidates. Today's Republican Party is too extreme, offers no positive agenda, and spends most of its time trying to figure out ways to spin events to hurt Democrats rather than coming up with solutions. Congratulations to Bob Dole, former Republican nominee for president and former Republican Senate Majority Leader, for winning this week's Hall of Fame for making great sense. Now our Hall of Shame this week for those politicians and prominent individuals who made shameful nonsense. In third place this week in our Hall of Shame, we have Iowa's Republican Senator Chuck Grassley. Senator Grassley was discussing President Obama's attempts to fill vacancies in the D.C. Court of Appeals when he said this.
The government, those who advocate for a type of court packing reminiscent of FDR's era, the response should not be to cry to pack the courts. Packing the court because it has issued rulings against the administration is a cynical approach to the judicial branch. So rather than packing the courts in the hopes of obtaining more favorable rulings, our consideration of judicial nominees for the D.C. Circuit should be even more measured. Concerns were raised that this nomination might be filibustered. Those concerns, I believe, were not only unfounded, but were simply put out there as a further justification to call for the president to pack the D.C. Circuit. And I'm well aware of the talk going on while I was speaking. If nobody cares what I said, they're going to continue to hear it over a long period of time because I'm concerned about the caseload of this circuit and the efforts to pack it.
Now, if you understand the term pack the court, you know how ridiculous that accusation is. Packing the court involves adding to the maximum possible amount of judges. As in, there are currently 9 Supreme Court justices. If President Obama wanted to change the ideological composition of the court, he theoretically has the right to try to appoint more justices. He could add another 4 and raise the total to 13. Of course, those appointments would have to pass the Senate, and I'm pretty certain that that would not work. But we're getting away from the point, right? Filling vacancies on the D.C. Court of Appeals for justices that have left that court is not packing the court. Something that Sheldon Whitehouse, the Democratic senator from Rhode Island, tried to explain to Senator Grassley.
I'm not sure how helpful it is to describe what's going on as an effort to pack the court. Packing the court is a phrase that emerged from the Roosevelt era. When there was an effort to add new seats to the Supreme Court in order to change its balance. What we're dealing with is existing vacancies on the D.C. Circuit, indeed 4 existing vacancies. To the extent that filling vacancies is packing the court, then you could just as easily argue that the court's already been packed by Republicans. I don't think that's a helpful way to have this discussion.
Well said, Senator Whitehouse. Senator Chuck Grassley is third this week in our Hall of Shame for worst nonsense of the week. In second place for even worse nonsense this week, we have Melissa and Aaron Klein of Sweet Cakes by Melissa in Gresham, Oregon, and Pam Regenton, operator for Fleur Cakes in Hood River, Oregon. Martin Sismar of Williamette Week, a newspaper out of Portland, Oregon, reports that this is a case of discrimination against people because of their sexual orientation. Now, both sets of owners in this situation refused to make a cake for a lesbian couple for their wedding. Sismark reports both bakeries cited their religious beliefs as the reason that they would not make the cakes. Both bakeries' owners describe themselves as Christian. His article goes on to note that five Williamette Week reporters called those two bakeries anonymously to get price quotes for other occasions frowned upon by some Christians. Now, surprisingly, the people who answered the phone at each bakery were quite willing to provide baked goods for celebrations of divorces, unmarried parents, stem cell research, non-kosher barbecues, and get this, pagan solstice parties. So let's get this straight. Gays were denied cakes for weddings due to those owners' Christian beliefs, but cakes for observance of witchcraft holidays are A-OK. Williamette Week later contacted both bakeries to ask about these inconsistencies. Pam Regenton declined to comment beyond asking whether she had been taped. And Sweet Cakes owners Melissa and Aaron Klein were upset that Williamette Week would, quote, even try to entrap a business, end quote. Well, these owners may get even more upset. You see, in Oregon, it's illegal to withhold goods or services on the basis of sexual orientation. And at least one of the lesbian couples that were denied services are contemplating a lawsuit. Melissa and Aaron Klein of Sweet Cakes by Melissa in Gresham, Oregon, and Pam Regenton, operator for Fleur Cakes in Hood River, Oregon, are runner-up this week in our Hall of Shame for infamous nonsense. But the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to Eric Erickson of RedState.com. A couple of days ago, Eric Erickson, the editor of RedState.com, was on Lou Dobbs Tonight in a panel discussing the Pew study that determined that women are now the primary source of income in 40% of American households. While the other panelists all made disturbing comments about something that should be celebrated as a progress toward equality for women, Erickson went a good deal farther than the other panelists.
Lou, I'm so used to liberals telling conservatives that they're anti-science, but I mean, this is liberals who defend this and say it's not a bad thing are very anti-science. When you look at biology, look at the natural world, the roles of a male and a female in society and other animals, the male typically is the dominant role. The female, it's not antithesis or it's not competing, it's a complementary role.
So it's science, according to Erickson, that men should have a dominant role in families. You're denying science if you disagree. And I still get nasty emails from Republicans when I claim that there's a Republican war on women. Republicans, as long as you celebrate the kind of misogyny that comes from people like Erickson and Rush Limbaugh and all the rest, I'm going to keep calling you out for your war on women. Eric Erickson, editor of RedState.com, wins the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week. That's all I have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, June 9th, and Monday, June 10th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me in the show on Twitter at Stephen Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.